The room where it happens. No one really knows how the game is played. The art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens. But no one else is in the room where it happens. When you got skin in the game, you stay in the game. But you don't get a win unless you play in the game. These excerpts were in a song by Leslie Odom Jr. and Lin-Manuel Miranda from Hamilton. But they could have also been applied to the conversation Lawrence Tosi of Westcap and I had today. Welcome back to the Alt Goes Mainstream podcast.
Everybody gets a piece, we're going mainstream. Everybody's gonna eat, we're going mainstream. All my family's sick. See you on Main Street, we're going mainstream.
From Wall Street to Melrose Avenue,
we're going mainstream.
Venture capitalists to athletes to
we're
creators.
Today's show is with someone who has been in the room where it happens. Stories and perspectives shared today were from someone who has helped turn Bill into law in private markets. Lawrence Tosi has been part of building foundational technology businesses and companies in capital markets and private markets. From founding, investing, and operating industry-changing companies such as Ipreo, iLevel, TMC Bonds, TheMarkets.com, TradeWeb, and Archipelago as an executive at Merrill Lynch, where he served as finance director and then COO of Global Investment Banking and Trading, to being part of the senior management team at Blackstone from 2008 to 2015 as the CFO, Management and Risk Committee member, Head of Tech Innovations Fund, and Blackstone Treasury Solutions Fund, to first investing in and then building and scaling Airbnb as CFO and Head of Payments, Customer Experience, and Corporate Development. At Merrill Lynch and Blackstone, LT deployed over $500 million of capital, returning over $1.6 billion without ever taking a loss. He's now building Westcap, a $7.6 billion growth investing firm that LT characterizes as an operating equity firm that helps founders and companies scale their businesses at the inflection point between traditional venture capital and private equity. LT and Westcap have leveraged their collective operating knowledge to invest in a number of industry leaders, including two industry-defining companies in private markets, iCapital and Adapar, where Westcap is one of the largest investors. They've also invested in the likes of Simon, which was acquired by iCapital, GoodLeap, Hopper, StubHub, Klarna, Paxos, Flyer, AppDirect, Flip, Avenue One, Treasury Four, and many more market-leading companies. LT and I had a fascinating conversation that took us to a number of places. We discussed stories from inside the building of Blackstone, insights LT and the Blackstone team had around working with the Wealth Channel that enabled them to transform how Blackstone and the industry worked with private wealth, why the realization that at Blackstone they weren't selling to the end investor, but that they were selling to the financial advisor was such a critical insight as they worked with the Wealth Channel, what it means to transform Blackstone from a private equity firm into a publicly traded business, parallels and patterns LT took from building and investing in foundational market infrastructure businesses at Merrill Lynch and Blackstone to how they are investing in private markets at Westcap, LT's learnings from a focus on customer experience and simplifying the product at Airbnb, what's the unlock for alternatives that harmonizes the industry, why consortium is a bad word, but why standardization will be so critical to the next phase of private markets, why private equity firms have the best business models in finance, the difference between typical alternative managers who are in the business of building their business by gathering assets, and Westcap, which is designed to be in the business of building transformational companies. In their words, Westcap is built to build. And why LT believes in the private partnership model for alternative asset managers, and why he believes that's an enduring model versus investment banks and traditional investment managers, which he believes will struggle to find success in alternatives. LT, thanks so much for coming on the Alt Goes Mainstream podcast to share your wisdom, experience, and deep industry knowledge from being a pioneer in private markets. We hope you enjoy. LT, welcome to the Alt Goes Mainstream podcast.
Thank you very much, Michael. Happy to be here.
Pleasure to have you on. You have such a fascinating career and background in private markets and beyond in tech as well. So you've had this career path that span virtually all aspects of the foundations of what really takes to build a successful company in financial services and private markets. So Would love to just start with what you learned from each of those experiences as you now think about really building the infrastructure for alts and wealth tech.
Well, I appreciate that, Michael. The way I look at it is, I don't know if it was by design or maybe by mistake, but over time, I was always searching for new, more interesting challenges that were out there. And so I've been a founder and part of the founding teams of four companies that have gotten to $1 billion of valuation. So in that, I'd have exposure to what it's like being a founder, what it's like building technology. The technologies I'd built were focused at the time on democratizing capital markets. So with Ipreo, I was looking to get new issuances, whether they be IPOs or they would be bond issuances in the hands of retail investors and beyond. With iLevel, it was a business that I built while I was at Blackstone that was to distribute information from portfolio companies to managers. With TMC Bonds, it was about distributing municipal bonds to retail investors. And then, of course, there was the markets.com, which is the research portals. As a founder, I looked at different ways of, if you will, opening up the markets more broadly. As an operator, my time at Merrill, I was CFO and was also Chief Operating Officer of Capital Markets and Investment Banking, followed that by some time at Blackstone, where I was one of the management committee members, partner, of course, and ran some of our digital investing as well as built our alternative infrastructure. And then at WestCap, I'm a full-time investor. You know, we have a large firm, $6 billion growth equity firm, and we invest in companies. So it's not necessarily by design, Michael, that I started with, but it was something that came to with each new challenge I was seeking.
What do you think has been the most important learning from each of those experiences now as you build companies in fintech and alts tech?
So I'd say the most important thing I learned is that it all comes down to, is there a great product that fits a need? And usually that needs more than one stakeholder. So if I think of like my time at Airbnb, we were building something that was certainly helpful to the hosts, but it was also helpful, of course, to the guests, the travelers. Or if I look back at Ipreo, it was very important to the banks to be able to control the flow of information and be able to distribute securities. It was also very important for the customers, the buyers, the buy side, as they call it, to be able to get transparency into a new IPO or debt issuance. I think it all starts with understanding products and the value that they're creating. And almost everything that I've invested in, built, and operated has been some sort of marketplace. Maybe that's the last piece. That marketplaces, I believe, are an undersized portion of early stage investing, but they're an outsized portion of public companies.
Let's break that down. Marketplaces are so foundational to most markets. Financial services has their own marketplaces in the form of exchanges. And otherwise, you could even look at Blackstone in a sense as a marketplace. How do you conceptualize what a marketplace is in financial services?
It's funny that when I often write the business plans of a business or something we're building, I always try to break it down to a very simple graphic. And that graphic usually has the buyer on one side, the seller. Now, the names may be different. So in the case of, as I said, Airbnb, it's host meets guests, with Airbnb in the middle. If you think about one of our largest investments in StubHub, that would be ticket seller, ticket buyer, StubHub in the middle. And for Blackstone, it's companies, Blackstone in the middle, managing them and managing the investments, and the other side of the investors and their capital. I think it's interesting in investing, especially in technology, only about 12% of early stage investments are in marketplaces, but they're 30% of public companies and 25% of unicorns, which is a really interesting stat to show you the power of marketplaces.
What's so valuable about the dynamic that marketplaces have that make them such important connective tissue businesses in any industry?
No, that's a really great question, Michael. I think it really comes down to an overused word, but I'll try to define it the right way, which is network effect. In the end, the best marketplaces create a network effect. I define the network effect as in each incremental customer or stakeholder on either side of the marketplace creates more value for the other marketplace participants because they create more liquidity. For example, the more funds that Blackstone has, the more places they can raise capital against, and the more places they can put that capital against ideas, everything from an infrastructure project to a private equity investment to a real estate investment. The best thing about marketplaces is, and we measure this, and we've got 25 years worth of analytics on it, you can measure the effectiveness of a marketplace simply by that flywheel or network effect that's created, that more buyers mean more sellers mean more buyers. And I think that's the magic of marketplaces.
That brings up such a fascinating point. I think it was Steve Schwarzman who said, scale is our niche. And that's such an interesting comment when you think about investing? Because when I think about that, I think about how do you balance the equilibrium of scale, as many of these firms like Blackstone and others are building, and the value that's created from that liquidity, like you say, with returns. And that's the other side of that for the investors and the other side of that marketplace. And generally, returns can be harder to come by the more scale you have, because as more capital comes into a space, it gets harder to generate returns. How do you think about scale in the context of alternative asset managers and what's happening in private markets, and then how you balance that with returns while thinking about just the building of these marketplace businesses?
I remember when Steve said that scale is niche. I'm going to add a second part, Michael, to that statement, which I guess gets less covered than he would say. He would also say that scale begets skill, and the more skill you can put against creating value, the more you can justify the scale. So in the early days of Blackstone, shortly after we went public, there was a lot of confusion about, well, how's this different from the 40 Act shops that do mutual funds, et cetera? And the answer was, we found businesses where skill really matters, i.e. finding businesses and knowing how to turn them around. And then we found a little bit of the golden rule that the more scale that we had, the more resources we would have at Blackstone to invest in creating alpha, if you want to call it that, or value creation. And so the scale actually made us more competitive. So if I think back when I joined the firm, I think our private equity fund was $6 billion and our real estate fund was probably $3 billion. Those are about now both 30. That difference in those is not just adding more assets like you would to a mutual fund or a hedge fund. Those assets have translated to deep operating teams, asset management teams that can actually help create value during the course of the hold. Also going out and finding more deals, negotiating them. The golden rule in investing is, where can you find a space that the more you invest in your returns, the greater the alpha you generate with? That's the right place to scale. If you don't have that, then scale doesn't create what Steve said, doesn't create, it's not your niche and doesn't create value. So that was the guiding force behind how that was built out.
I want to dive a bit more into what you just said in the context of Blackstone building the business itself, the business of Blackstone. And you had a front row seat. You were a big part of building Blackstone's business, not just with institutional investors, but with the wealth channel. I want to talk about that. We obviously understand and recognize the importance of the wealth channel today. You've invested in foundational companies in this space to help do that, in iCapital, Addepar, et cetera. What was your view on the wealth channel when you were at Blackstone, CFO on the management committee? How did you think about that in 2008, and how did that evolve over time?
A little bit of history. My first job as a CFO was the CFO of Private Client at Merrill Lynch before I was COO. And I had seen, of course, the distribution of retail products to a wide swath. I think at the time I arrived at Blackstone, Merrill Lynch probably had about 14,500 advisors and just under $1 trillion of assets. And actually, I was surprised when I got to Blackstone how little we were selling private equity, real estate, and our other strategies into these retail channels. There were sales for sure, but if I recall, Merrill, Morgan Stanley, and JP Morgan were not even top 20 investors. And I'm talking about their clients. We're not even top 20 investors at Blackstone. And we started thinking through, how do we more appropriately address that giant retail opportunity, or retail high net worth, whatever you want to call it. So we spent about a 2-year journey. I remember working on it with Tony James, who was the president, and Joan Solotar, who actually runs that business now. And the three of us spent the better part of a year interviewing people in kind of what I've described as the discovery phase, which was typical for a Blackstone project. We spent year and a half interviewing people and understanding it. And it was interesting. At first, there was definitely a debate amongst the management committee as to what was the value of retail. And there was, a preconception that individual investors, represented by their financial advisors, were too cyclical or too fickle, if you want to use that word, to actually consistently be in our funds, much the way that some of our core pension funds, endowments would be. And so there was a little bit of a rock to push up that hill. And that's where it started. We started doing this discovery phase, and we came up with what I think was a very unique strategy to address it.
What were the answers that you received from these private banks or end investors that convinced you, you know what, we should be working with the wealth channel? And then the following question is, how?
So it's interesting. I've always tried to distill initiatives or a phase in a market down to a simple phrase. And there were really two things that we said, and it'll sound somewhat corny, I guess, now these years later. But the first couple decks we put together about Blackstone selling alternative products into these networks of financial advisors at the major banks, we used two words. One was democratize alternatives. And by that, what we meant was we would allow more people at a wider audience to access the products. That was the first one that was really important to us. And the second one we thought about was, okay, we could democratize access, but we have to do it in a different way. So we had this saying at Blackstone, we call it the innovation advantage. And we'd say, what's our innovation advantage? So it was democratize alternatives, and what's our innovation advantage? I remember using that in early conference calls at Blackstone with the analysts. And the difference was, and this was a surprising result, Michael, when we went and did the analysis, we said, people have it wrong. We're not actually selling to the end investor. We're selling to the financial advisor who understands the context of the individual investor's life and wealth and exposures. And if we could sell to the advisors will turn around and be our best advocates, not just to one client, but all the clients. That was one realization. The second one was when you looked at advisors, it actually wasn't every advisor at Merrill Lynch, for example. There's 14,500 advisors when we started the retail business at Blackstone. And it was actually only about 250 advisors in the group they call PBIG, or Private Banking Investment Group. And that was the group that we started focusing on. We did the same thing at UBS, same thing at Morgan Stanley. We started with their most successful financial advisors, and we started by educating them. The third kind of corny statement we came up with was Blackstone University, which obviously it wasn't a university. Surely neither myself nor Steve Schwarzman could be considered professors. But the idea was really to bring financial advisors in who were very savvy, but not many of them had exposure alternatives. We would literally bring them in to a conference room. And I can remember Steve would give the opening speech about how Blackstone's returns were always what was most important to the company. And that still remains to the day. And that's why I think Blackstone's special. But also give a speech about how we were investing in the returns and why those returns would make sense over time in the context of more than just one business. So we showed Blackstone as a platform. We even renamed the businesses that we were in to make them more accessible and more understandable to the financial advisors. Real estate at the time was Blackstone Real Estate Equity Partners, and private equity was Blackstone Capital Partners. We're like, that's too confusing. We're going to call it Blackstone Real Estate, Blackstone Private Equity. Believe it or not, that actually made a difference. And we'd bring advisors in and we'd bring in the deal teams. And the deal teams would just go through the process of how do we find the company? What was our thesis for creating more value? How do we execute against that? And how do we exit? It was really taking that Blackstone core value of innovation advantage and rethinking all aspects of high net worth channels and how to approach them. And that indirect approach turned out to be the winning approach of going to the financial advisors.
So many interesting things in there about how you had to reconfigure the way in which you thought about Blackstone as a business to LPs. You had these amazing institutional LPs. So did you need to do this at the time, or did you think, okay, this could be a growth area for the firm? And if there was some of that internal tension, what was that like?
It's interesting. After the IPO, our corporate shareholder base of Blackstone itself, BX, was very institutional. So we actually didn't have any retail. We really started launching it. We actually mixed the two together. I can remember giving a speech in 2009 to all the advisors at Merrill Lynch, which was a kind of a homecoming for me, and explaining to them, if these alternative projects are too difficult, let me tell you why BX, Blackstone itself, is a great investment. And I would explain how you'd get carried interest as capital gains, and then you'd have the steady income of what then we coined the term net fee-related earnings. So it started kind of in parallel. We were looking at the high net worth channels. We were also trying to get Blackstone itself more distributed, and it worked really well. And so advisors started recommending to their clients, buy Blackstone itself, get to know their business, and when the funds come around, we can do that. That's one. The second thing we had to solve was, because our private equity and real estate businesses are what they call episodic fundraises, meaning we would only be out to fundraise every 4 years, well, that's not really the right way to build a portfolio and it takes too long. So we created a product called BTAS, which was effectively, we could have a high net worth client come into the funds in a year and they could get real estate, credit, private equity, and hedge fund exposure all at once. And so we had to adapt our products, if you will, to a way that would sell well in retail.
That's a really interesting point, because I think if we look at the alt space now, so many firms beyond Blackstone have innovated on the product side to offer some call them evergreen funds, some call them semi-liquid, just finding ways to work with more investors. What was that like in the early days? Because it's not just the distribution aspect of these products, but it's also the operational and administrative aspect of these products and working with a whole new set of investors that makes this challenging. How did you get around that early days before much of this alt tech innovation that has occurred in the last few years wasn't readily available?
So I agree with you. I still think the distribution support and transparency around alternative investor products, the capital spent on the tools necessary, the platforms necessary, is behind. And so there's a big opportunity ahead, I think, to invest in, let's call it, tools and platforms that enable broader access to alternatives. That's why we're one of the largest shareholders in Addepar, one of the largest shareholders in iCapital. But let me go back to part of your question, Michael. There's really two parts. One was, we learned that we needed perhaps a different set of products or fund offerings that would apply to a wider set of investors. And so one of the early projects that we did, we acquired Strategic Partners, which is the secondaries business, from Credit Suisse. Tony had run that business and knew the team from when Tony James was running Credit Suisse. He introduced us to Steve Kahn and Vern Perry. And as soon as we saw that, we saw a product, if you will, in secondaries that had a more shallow J curve, which is the period between the first dollar invested and the commitment being returned and then the gains. It had a shallower J curve. They had an excellent team. Steve and Vern are two of the most talented people I've ever worked with. And we saw that as a product that would sell really well to, let's say, first-time alternative buyers. And today, that's a $50 billion business. I think it was $4 billion when we invested. I'd say the same thing about GSO. We acquired that. Those products right now, I think it was $300 billion, Blackstone Credit. It was about $4.5 billion when we acquired it. So we started thinking through a lens of, how do we find the right products? And the second part of your question was what are we going to do now that this is really working? What are we going to do for infrastructure? We didn't have an alternative, Michael. There was nothing out there. I met with every company I could find. I was running technology and operations at Blackstone at the time, in addition to being CFO and on the management committee. And there just wasn't anything. So we started building, and we built what we called BX Access. It's still to this day. It was the first portal of its type where we could then serve many more clients so they could see their information. So we didn't have that same high touch model that restricted our ability to deal with retail in the past. That would allow us to bring the minimums down. I think when I arrived at Blackstone, the smallest investment they would take in real estate or private equity was $5 million. By the way, that eliminates about 90% of retail clients. And so we started building platforms. We did early relationship with iCapital. We invested in iCapital, I think, in 2009, and started building out our ability to leverage platforms or build them ourselves. We rebuilt the administrative platform inside, which is the waterfall for calculating all the different funds across Blackstone. I said BX Access, we did the reporting, we created a master database. So we were able to scale to where it's now $1 trillion of assets, which of course was unthinkable to me when I was trying to figure out just how to deal with 40 or 50 billion. But that was important. And it told me a lot that we had to build it ourselves. And so for the last 10 years, I've been investing in and building in private market technology to serve alternatives, because there's a gap in the market and still remains today.
I just want to highlight something you said, which I love, which the irony is not lost on me, saying we didn't have an alternative. So now I think that we're at a point where there is no alternative. Before we get to the alt tech and the innovation there, I just want to cover, because you saw the guts of these businesses, building and running Blackstone as the CFO, just the businesses themselves. I'd love to hear your views on the alternative asset management business itself, because GP staking is growing in size and scale. Blackstone has its own staking business as well. Others do too. What about alternative asset managers make them, A, such great businesses, and B, I think this actually dovetails in well with the wealth channel, because that's a growth area. So how do you think about all that in the context of these companies as businesses?
I'll tell you kind of a funny story. The way I met Steve Schwarzman and Tony James was, Merrill Lynch had invested in GSO. I had led that investment, so I got to know Bennett Goodman, Tripp Smith, and Doug Ostrover. And when Blackstone went to acquire it, I think at the time we owned about 20% of the business, and WestCap at that time was a multifamily office, so we had a small portion of that investment. And when it came time to take stock or cash, I said, I'll take all cash. And you can see that did not go over well with my partners at Blackstone, my future partners. And my reasoning was, I just didn't get the business, Michael. I was like, this thing is so complicated. They have something called economic net income. I'm like, what even is that? And the gap reporting for Blackstone had them amortizing all the partner shares against the P&L, and it had them consolidating all the debt associated with the funds. So honestly, on a piece of paper at the time of the IPO, it looked terrible. So I took just cash, and then a couple months later, got a call, I think it was from Bennett, said you should go meet Tony and Steve and kind of talk to the business. And the first time I sat down with both of them separately, I started saying, well, how do you explain this business to anybody? I don't get it. Is that your debt, or is that the debt for the funds or the companies? And so that began the process of articulating the businesses in the right way. So we came up with this word, net fee-related earnings. We came up with distributable earnings, and we started explaining to people, think of Blackstone as a series of long-term contracts with a 50% margin. That's called fee-related earnings. And on top of that, you get the upside from these performance fees, which are not like a trading desk at Goldman, because they can only be positive, because you can't have negative performance fees. And that's how to look at it. So that's when we started thinking of a firm, became more of a business, and how to think about it. The one key thing I think that's differentiated Blackstone over all this time is it was always absolutely paramount that the returns and the quality of everything we did was the best. And Steve used to sell people to the partners. We would have a dinner a couple nights before earnings every quarter. And I think they still do it, Michael. And really, that was the first time that the partners would actually see what you'd call the P&L and the categories I was just describing. And what Steve would say is, look, we'll run the business. You make great returns and everything will take care of itself. And I've never forgotten that. I think about that when I think about WestCap, is that AUM targets, that kind of stuff, that doesn't work. What really works is build great businesses that get great returns. Everything else will take care of itself. So that's how we thought about the business.
Having been someone who helped pick alternative asset managers to run specific businesses, you mentioned strategic partners, you mentioned GSO. Blackstone has either built or acquired other businesses. You've had to pick people to do that. You're now building and running your own fund too in WestCap. What do you think it takes to be both a good fund manager or investor and good business builder in the alternative space?
It's an interesting question. I would say that I think that Steve Schwarzman and the team at Blackstone were early pioneers in being able to balance the both. I would say one of the big differences was, if you look at the management committee of Blackstone, not only are they all business builders, but they're all investors. Some companies have had professional managers come in or whatever. That's not how it really works. At Blackstone, everybody's, if you will, a player coach in the sense that they're managing risk. I was managing the treasury fund. I was managing our innovation funds, which was technology investors. We all had something we were managing as investors. We were in front of our LPs, our public investors, and that was informing us how to build the highest quality company. We weren't doing it like we were just asset gatherers or we were managing a corporate. And that was deep in our DNA. So we had to all be business builders, investors, et cetera. And we would let the different divisions, if you will, real estate, private equity, credit, we would let those partners running those businesses build their businesses. We set up the structures to incent them to build great, high quality businesses. And that's what they did. The key contribution, I think, that Steve Schwarzman and the Blackstone culture brought to alternatives was entrepreneurship. To run a business at Blackstone, you have to be a real entrepreneur. And I think of the same thing when I think of WestCap. I'm surrounded by not just great investors, but we brought in great operators. We were able to build a scale business that makes sense and is poised to make the right returns because we can reinvest in the alpha that we're generating.
I want to get to that in a minute because you have invested in so many interesting companies, particularly in the alt space. But before we do, where do you see the alt space going? How does this industry evolve?
We've seen a lot of evolution. In fact, it's happened probably faster than the mutual fund industry. Probably took 20 years to go from a financial advisor recommending buying a stock or buying a mutual fund to the ETF world we're in today. I think in half that time, alternatives have gone from something that was really not understood or really available to a lot of individual investors. By the way, those high net worth channels and banks, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, JP Morgan, are now probably three of the top five clients at all Blackstone, to give you an idea of how it's been received. And that happened really 15 years in this business. That is really fast to be able to have that transformation. Where does it go from here? I think you'll see more innovation in products that make more sense for retail individuals. I think you'll see more firms embracing what Blackstone did. And frankly, for years when we were building out retail, I was surprised at how little the other major alternative firms were doing in retail. Now it's like everybody's chasing the ball, but Blackstone's got a 15-year head start. And frankly, the market spotted them a 15-year head start, and that's because they were brave enough to do it. But I think more and more firms like myself, in just the last several years, almost 25% of the assets at WestCap are exactly high net worth individuals from the top banks like JP Morgan and UBS. That was unthinkable when Blackstone started 35 years ago. There were no retail investors. And so it has evolved very quickly. What I think happens from here, Michael, and it's podcasts like yours, the effort you'd made, getting the word out there, people are realizing that there are trade-offs, of course, with alternatives like liquidity, but there's also real wealth building over time. And I think it'll become more applicable. I think the business will continue to outgrow the rest of asset management. But here's this problem that you and I have to solve. We just got to get the infrastructure to catch up because it's still too far behind. It's still too hard.
Infrastructure, that's where I want to go next. I'm actually going to look back to go forward. And I want to start with your time at Merrill. You mentioned a few of those companies that you built. I think it's fascinating to think about some of those foundational businesses that you built. Ipreo, iLevel, TMC Bonds, obviously in different asset classes, but where I'd love to start to then go all the way forward, and we'll thread this throughout your career from Merrill to Blackstone to Airbnb to WestCap, is how do you think about these prior market structure evolutions which you help build with those companies? And how do you apply some of those frameworks and learnings to the alts market structure evolution?
A bit of it, maybe I'm dating myself, is just pattern recognition. It made sense to me when I saw people on the trading floor at Merrill, and they were using spreadsheets to accumulate IPO orders from the asset managers. And they would have a little spreadsheet. It would say such and such, Fidelity wants this much at this price. Meanwhile, on the high net worth or the private wealth part of Merrill, they couldn't get access to the very IPOs that Merrill was underwriting. I was like, this makes no sense to me. Why don't we just automate the book building piece and then we can connect it in a way we can distribute it to a wider audience? A lot of what I've done over my career is just pattern recognizes places where there's inefficiency that can be overcome. And by connecting the different constituents around a marketplace, you can create acceleration. That's really the method to the madness. iLevel, we built when we were at Blackstone, and it was simply that I couldn't understand that every quarter I had to sign my name to the financial statements at a risk of perjury and probably worse. And I was realizing we weren't getting fresh financials from the companies. We were getting 6 months old, and they were going through the hands of analysts in private equity or real estate. And I don't really know. There's like interpretive stuff. Like, I don't know what adjusted EBITDA is. There's only one EBITDA as far as I know under GAAP. So we built iLevel with the team. Harry Mosley was the CTO of the time, and he had started the project before I got there. And together, we figured out how to externalize it. We realized that the industry needed a way to track their assets in private equity and real estate. That did not exist. So I look for pattern recognition where there's a need, a use case, and it involves more than one. What's interesting about all the businesses, these businesses we built, we didn't build them by ourselves. The first investors in iLevel were Carlyle and Hamilton Lane. The first investors in Ipreo were Microsoft and Citigroup. And I could go on and on. So we always got industry participants to work with us to scale. And that's the pattern recognition over time that we saw.
I want to double click on that last statement because I think that's so important to alts. And you've invested in one company that has certainly done that. And I think that's been part of its reason for success, iCapital, with all the banks and the private equity firms or alternative asset managers, investors. How different do you think alts is from other areas of fintech or other industries, which you also invest into, in that context of having strategic investor involvement earlier on? Does that generally tip the odds in favor of success in a bigger way than it might in other industries?
So I'll tell you a little bit of a theory that I had. This was in the original deck when we started building BX Access and we started building iLevel. And frankly, we built the distribution channel, was that alternative asset managers, because they're largely in partnership format, really don't like CapEx. They really don't like long-term investment in technology because that's basically the partners are funding it themselves out of their own pocket. So they tend to underinvest in their technology. For Blackstone, when we went public, it was a matter of survival. We had like 100 accountants from Deloitte and Touche working full-time in the basement of 385 Park. And I was thinking to myself, we got to automate this. It has to be automated. And today they've been able to scale. It is chronically underinvested in because a lot of the GPs are just not incented to put capital in. Where we broke through was we said, okay, if we dare to find it, build it, create it, we should bring others on board because it'll breathe more life into the product and it'll become definitive. Today, iLevel, which we started, cost us $3.5 million to build the first version. It's $2 billion of equity value now for S&P. And that's only been 12 years. It's remarkable. I think it's been chronically underinvested in. I think there will be more places where more companies will be built. Stay tuned. We've got a few that we're working on. I will tell you a kind of funny anecdote. The first time I saw iCapital, I actually was offended by it because I was like, well, we could do that. And so actually, I said no to the investment. My partners at the time at Park Hill went ahead and did the investment because they could understand that distributing their clients through iCapital would make sense. That was Dan Prendergast, the founder of Park Hill, Sean Keen, Brian Levine. I said no. And I went off and built BX Access. And then one day the light went on. I was like, oh no, BX Access is Blackstone to its clients. It'd be much more valuable if we were Blackstone to many clients. And then eventually we invested in iCapital.
I remember some of those early conversations when people came back to the office after those, after some of those meetings. So an interesting kind of framework here is, okay, so it's important to have strategic involvement. Now, unique in the alt space. At Merrill, since you were investing in a lot of these businesses, how much did you think about the future of some of these different asset classes? So, and you said this even earlier in the conversation, you were like, hey, look, I look back at my career and all the dots now make sense. And I think that's how we often do it. But I want to take the reverse, actually. So when you were building iPrio at the time, did you believe that this would be the foundational framework, not just for the IPO markets and equities markets, but also for how private markets would evolve? Or was it too early to even think about private markets in that context?
I think what iLevel taught me was when we first went out, I remember the first time I had my little pitch book and I went over to Goldman Sachs and I went through it. I won't embarrass the people in the room at the time. They took my book and threw it back at me and said, we're not going to use this Merrill technology. By the way, 14 years later, they paid $425 million for the pleasure of having half the stake they would have had if they believed me when I first showed it to them. That's just the way the world works. I remind them of that all the time. But what surprised me was actually the best and most effective solutions are not one-off. They're shared by the industry. And those marketplaces get bigger. I can remember when the investment at Merrill, we put $5 million into Tradeweb, I think for 20% of the business with four other firms, JP Morgan, Goldman, and I forget the fourth. That business is $20 billion now. It's more valuable than any of the trading desks at the time that we're setting it now. It has more business. So it was the business model of a marketplace, and it was getting these other participants in the market. There would be no iCapital if it was captive to a single firm. The magic of it is that it's across all firms, and therefore each firm that puts a product on it benefits the other firms as new clients sign up to buy product on the platform.
You have perspective of this, both you were a strategic investor in one seat at one point in time. Now you're a financial investor with the benefit of the background you had as a strategic investor and all the connections you have. The challenge often that both investors and operators have with getting a consortium of strategics is that the fear that it becomes the industry consortium or the industry utility. How do you think about that concept of when it becomes the industry utility, then sometimes it doesn't create economic value for both the operators and the financial investors in the business like you are today?
But to us, the word consortia is a dirty word because there were some cases where we had too much industry participation in the platform and that it became captive. I would say that's what happened with themarkets.com. We sold it for $250 million to S&P. But we had too many owners across too many of the banks who thought it was their thing, and therefore it never became what it was. The magic is to balance industry participation with an entrepreneurial goal and leaders who want to build value. If iCapital today was just an industry consortia, or like DTCC would be, the Depository Trust Clearing Corp, it really wouldn't be a great business because they would chase all the innovation. Someone as talented as Lawrence Calcano, the CEO, is not going to go work for consortia. So over time, we tried to figure the places where we could make it a business that had business alignment with the operators, like in the case of iPrio with Scott Ganellis and Kevin Marcus. They were fully motivated to build a world-class business alongside the industry. Had we given up too much control or participation, we would have been stuck with a consortia. And there's another really dirty word for that. It's called utility. Nobody ever bragged about running a utility, no less founding one or building one.
It's a great point. When you think about the genesis of some of these businesses, in the bank world, it seemed like banks would often get together and decide, hey, we all need to build this. So we all need to fund this. And it was some industry utility. It could have been post-trade or clearing or business and post-trade processing, whatever it may be. Here in alts, it does seem like there's more of the founder or founders saying, hey, we want to build this. Let's go get a bunch of strategic investors involved early on, rather than a bunch of large alternative asset managers saying, hey, we need this. Let's share this risk. Let's try to build this for the industry. Would you say that's correct?
I think it hasn't happened yet, Michael, but I think it's going to happen. Let me give you an example. Today, a certain investor from any LP is identified, processed, and served by all the major alternative firms completely differently. Some of the LPs, one of the large pension funds here on the West Coast in California, it's 15% of their assets are in alternatives and it's 40% of their cost base. It's a mess. People are spending too much. There's one of the firms in New York, one of the big private equity firms. They have 1,200 back office people sitting in Midtown in the most expensive building they could find. That's all going to come apart. I do believe there will be the emergence of shared platforms, just like there was for iLevel in private equity and now real estate. Those platforms will emerge and they will be powerful and they will be shared across the industry, and no one private equity firm or alternative firm will dominate them. It'll be a balance of power and billion-dollar assets will be built.
Paint us a picture for what those platforms that you're describing look like.
First of all, there should be, as there is in Wall Street firms, you have a master security database, you have a client identifier, you have an industry code. I could keep going. You have standard financials. None of that exists in alternatives. That will change. Because what happens today, first I'll start with an institution, then I'll go individual. For an institution, it is wildly painful to manage an investment in a private equity. It takes time. It's administrative. The wires for contributions, distributions are manual. They need to be checked. The accounting comes out once a year. You don't have any visibility into when the drawdowns are going to happen. You get really disparate reporting in PDFs once a quarter, several weeks after by each firm. It's a mess. For the individuals, it's cost prohibitive. If you ask any individual who's invested in multiple private equity or alternative funds, as we are, we have a fund of funds internal to West Capital. I think we have about 15 managers in there. It's a nightmare. We have full-time people dedicated to it. That will change. The customers, in this case, the investors, will demand it, big and small. The retail investors will want to do automatic contributions, distributions. They'll want to have automatic reporting. They'll want all their investments in one place. They're not going to load into blahblahblah.com from this alternative investor. They'll want it in one place. And I think the institutional investors will also demand better transparency, transferability of assets, and things like that. I think there's a long way to go, but I think it'll happen much faster than people think.
How much do you think that all this innovation that's happening on the individual investor side, all these technology companies that are building to help enable the large alternative asset managers work with the wealth channel, deal with the true end client relative to the institution, how much do you think that innovation there will actually reference back and create innovation for the institutional investor, like you say?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And so let me try to connect two dots and pattern recognize this. In the early days of Wall Street technology, before the consortiums like Tradeweb, BrokerTec, Ibrio, the markets, TMC, before those were put together, there were lots of small companies that were saying, I'm going to revolutionize retail bond trading. I'm going to make a matching network for trading fixed income securities. All of that, in the end, pushed the innovation curve, but all of it ended up being toys. It was all toys. When I mean toys, I mean pejoratively, small companies. It all changed when the big players like a Merrill Lynch, a Goldman Sachs, a Morgan Stanley, a Citigroup, we all sat in the room across the table from each other and said, we got to solve research. We got to all be one portal and it doesn't have to go through Thomson Reuters. That can't be the way it works. Or we need to be able to sell bonds, liquid bonds, without having to go through voice brokers. So when we all got together and built the platforms, we took the ideas that were already being built by these smaller companies and built it at scale. I think the same thing's going to happen with alternatives. If I told you today that most of the private capital solutions that are solving the client problem of facing off to alternatives are toys. They're not that interesting. They're not very scaled. Maybe you've got Carta, iLevel, Addepar, iCapital. Those are real big businesses, but there's like eight other places where you're doing contributions, distributions, reporting that haven't been touched. There's a lot of small companies trying it. But when the biggest players, Blackstone's, Apollo, KKR, Carlyle, the market leaders get together and decide that there's certain things they need to share for the benefit of their clients, that's when you're going to see the next new multi-billion dollar business like an iCapital or an Addepar.
And that you think that's a totally independent business that connects the tissue between all of those.
Yes. If you could make the amount that the alternative managers spent on servicing their clients lower and make their clients happier because they have a less fragmented experience, the flywheel of selling more alternatives will go faster and the companies will frankly be more profitable. That is going to happen. The question is who and when.
Is there a kind of missing link or unlock that if something specific were to happen, I'll just throw out some ideas and could be those, it could be others, but like KYCing all the investors and having them have a passport across different funds and making it easy for them to allocate to funds and be KYC, or portfolio construction as another example, understanding everybody, iCapital partnered with Morningstar. That's one example of that in a sense. What is that one unlock? Or maybe there's multiple unlocks.
There might be multiple, Michael. I think the examples you just gave, those solutions are out there, but they're point to point. And KYC is less likely to be something that you could harmonize across the industry. But you're getting close to where I think things will go. People will eventually figure out which functions are not competitive. They're somewhat commoditized, but they're more efficient if we do them across. The unlock here, to use your word, which I think is the right one, is that alternative asset managers, we talked about, they're not incented to invest in technology for the long term. They're different than the banks. In the early days when we were setting up like a Tradeweb, for example, all of us had thousands of technologists on staff and we could hook into Tradeweb and it would work. And then we could add more asset classes over time. The alternative managers are a little harder because most of them have homegrown solutions or many, many solutions brought in from the outside that are all pieced together in patchwork. And that's what we try to avoid at Blackstone, really to build our own systems internally and scale them. Those solutions don't exist yet. That's probably the biggest unlock right now is that if you said, okay, we're going to have a certain master database for all clients, I'm not sure that all those firms could even harmonize a certain client identity across their own systems from real estate to private equity, et cetera. A lot of them don't do that.
Where I want to go from here is connecting what you just said to your experience at Airbnb, which I find is fascinating to go from CFO of largest alternative asset manager to CFO of a travel, but also payments company. What you just talked about is really all about user experience in alts. So what did you take from that experience at Airbnb around incredible user experience on both the front end and the back end to how you think about private markets today?
It's a little bit of background. I remember when we first announced that I was going to Airbnb, and I told Steve Schwarzman months and months before that I was considering it. His first reaction was, are you having a midlife crisis? I said, well, two things. I'm not at midlife yet, and no, I'm not having a crisis. The real issue was I've always found myself more of a pioneer than a settler, and I thought that there were people that were better to maintain and scale Blackstone than myself. I think Michael Chae has done an amazing job as my successor, but I felt like the days of the pioneering were going more to scaling versus pioneering, and I really wanted to go to something new and interesting. And when I met Brian Chesky, I was blown away by his vision and, frankly, his abilities, because he was such a great thinker about product. The Airbnb years I was there was just a great experience. And I really did spend a lot of time on product. So I had a couple of different product groups reporting to me. One was payments, one was customer service. And what I realized was when you really think about Airbnb, they've made it so simple for 7 million homeowners to list their home in a matter of minutes. And then by the same token, if you could believe it, at the early days of Airbnb, when I first got there, we didn't have that many people that could book a home right there on the spot and do it. It was always by referral. You'd send basically a message over the platform to the owner. The owner would say, great, Michael, you're welcome to join us on such and such a date. I think at the time, only 10% of the listings were what we called instant book. What I saw was taking a complicated problem through the eyes of a brilliant developer, engineer, designer, and Brian Chesky and the team around him, the other two founders, Joe Gebbia and Nate Plucharczyk. And they simplified a very complicated problem in a way no one else had. It's not like renting homes was anything new. The bed and breakfast, or before that, the inn, has been going on for 1,000 years probably. And HomeAway was out there, VRBO. The difference was Airbnb had, if you will, the audacity of the dream of making booking a home as safe, as informed, and as easy as booking a hotel. And they did it. So I saw the power of simple, large cap, scale, technology. We took 60 currencies, $60 billion of processed payments a year and turned it into something that simple. I think that those learnings are now informing the companies we're investing in and informing the product vision we're bringing them to just make it easier. It's still just too complicated. Even the bank websites, my first website I built was CNBC.com when I was at NBC. I still find the bank websites like wickedly confusing. I look at Airbnb as simple. Those words will merge and we're going to do it.
How much alt innovation do you think will come from outside the industry? When I think of what you just said, and I envision how you describe what the Airbnb founding team did, they came from out of industry to build something so innovative for an industry. Will alt have that same thing happen?
So just on that, for one thing, you're right. The Airbnb founders came from outside the industry. They also thought about the customer first and they didn't have any preconceived notions. I asked them one time, well, why are you charging the host 3% and the guest 12%? And they're like, because we need more hosts. Oh, yeah, it makes sense. If they had looked at the model, they would have seen that VRBO and HomeAway were doing the opposite. And a follower would have followed what it was doing, and they just weren't encumbered by those kind of legacy thoughts. And that was part of the genius of the innovation. Same thing here. The companies that we're working with, we just announced a deal a couple months ago with a company called Treasury 4. It was started by one of the technologists that built out Microsoft's platform, and after that, another platform, as well as a professional CFO. They're automating the ability for companies to move cash between their entities, and ultimately that will apply to alternatives. That's an outsider disrupting the industry. I think there'll be a lot of that, Michael. When I first saw Addepar, it was a reporting tool. Now it's becoming a disruptive marketplace, and they're able to do analytics and asset allocation and tracking returns. iCapital was relatively narrow. It was signing up people to alternatives. They've innovated. So some of it will come from outside the industry, I think, for sure, and it'll happen. And we're seeing great companies do that.
What do you think will be the skill sets that someone from outside of industry has that will make that work?
If you think about it, just think about my own firm at WestCap. We have about 20 people from Airbnb, including one of the lead designers, two heads of growth marketing, former head of product. When they look at some of the financial applications, to be honest, Michael, that we use, they're like, that is the ugliest, least intuitive thing I've ever seen in my life. So giving them the opportunity at WestCap to go into some of the companies we're with. We were just working on a design sprint for Addepar. We've done some work for iCapital. We're building some stuff for Treasury 4. You're seeing the two worlds right in front of me on a product basis. I'm seeing the two worlds combine to a better result. It's absolutely intentional putting people with experiences around retail products or consumer products into and to help demystify, simplify, and frankly, productize on a mass basis alternatives. And it's happening. It's happening in treasury. It's happening in subscription lines. It's happening in marketing materials. It's happening.
Yeah, it's such an interesting point and concept. And I wonder what alts can learn from the consumer tech world that you were in. Because if you think about it, we'll go back to your former firm, Blackstone. A lot of people made fun of their holiday video, the Taylor Swift Eras themed holiday video. I get why people made fun of it. I actually thought it was absolutely brilliant. What it did was it humanized private markets. How does the kind of learnings from the consumer tech world come to this space? Because at the end of the day, everyone is the end consumer. That end consumer, even for a pension fund, is ultimately the individual. It's the teacher. It's the policeman, the fireman. How does this space evolve in that way? And are you seeing that happen, this humanization of private markets?
You know, it's a great question. I thought it was hysterical, and I thought it took a lot of guts to do it. John Gray has done a great job not only running the business, but kind of pushing it that next mile. And I think it's absolutely intentional to humanize, if you will, Blackstone in a way that makes it more approachable. They're saying now, I think they use the term build with Blackstone. And I think that's a really great way to look at it. One of the things as a culture we always do is, can we simplify the way we talk about what we're doing so people can understand? When I was giving speeches to the retail clients, I'd say like, how many of you own a house? How many of you own a business? How many of you own the building that your business is in? All these hands will go up. I'm like, you're in the alternative business. And then I'll look at each other and go, what? I'm like, you are already in the illiquid asset alternative business. You just don't call it that. And all we do is find businesses like yours, and we turn them over to great returns. They're like, ah, I get it, because you got a good return on your house, good return on the building your office is in. So I think there's work to be done. I think this podcast, Michael, and that's why I jumped on, you know, I've known each other for a while. When I saw what you were doing, it's more efforts like this to get the word out there. And honestly, we kind of have a duty to do it. We need to demystify the alternatives. It used to call it private equity. There's nothing private about it. And so I actually think Blackstone has a deep passion that started way back when I was there, to actually bring these products. They used to say Merrill Lynch brought Wall Street to Main Street. That's how I thought about Blackstone in the early days when we were starting to do retail was, how do we bring this amazing franchise and returns to the average people who frankly could benefit from it quite a bit? I think that's a passion that I've had for 20 years, is to bring more availability, more democracy, more fairness to financial products in an informed and controlled way to more families, to frankly address things like the wage gaps and wealth gaps. And so there's a higher purpose to what they're doing. And I'll finish with this. I was at a Bank of America event last weekend, and they were reminding me that about 5 years ago when I was at Airbnb, I was giving this speech to the Bank of America bankers. Somebody asked me, how do we attract new people to Bank of America to work for us? Because nobody wants to work for an investment bank. I said, stop calling yourself an investment bank. They all laughed. I'm like, no, let me explain why. Explain to them that you're connecting capital and great ideas. That's how you get a young dreamer, talented person out of school to work for you. Stop calling yourself an investment bank. That's how I feel like alternatives. Let's not call it alternatives anymore. It's really mainstream investing in asset classes. We should think about it as access to real estate without having to buy a whole building. It's access to companies and their development before they're public, because 95% of companies are private. We have to talk about the industry differently so people will demystify. It's not like some velvet rope in front of a fancy club where you can keep people out. It should be just the opposite. And I think in Blackstone's case, they've led the way. They've shown you they can be funny about it. And I think that had a much more powerful impact than people realize.
You said Blackstone led the way. You were part of pioneering that effort. You say that you like being a pioneer more than a settler. Now you're building WestCap. What are you trying to pioneer with WestCap?
When two growth equity firms invest in Ipreo, I was surprised that with three board seats each, that the skill sets of all six people were relatively similar. They're great people, super talented, of course, but they were really focused on the financial return and not on the product. And I said, well, during the period where you're scaling, you need somebody who can help you scale. The same token, I think, having now run one of the most valuable private companies in the world with Airbnb, and I saw the venture capitalists who were incredibly helpful, but they didn't have people that could help us scale through issues like getting kicked out of New York or starting vacation rentals or business travel. What I realized was there's a gap between the idea formation phase, which venture capitalists really qualified to build, and these late stage kind of financial investors who come in and try to capture business before it goes public. And in the middle is the period of greatest opportunity, greatest threat, fastest growth, and potentially fastest appreciation in value. That's where we sit. That's called growth. It's not hedge funds. It's not asset gathering. It's growth. And in, during the growth phase, if you can help people scale in a thoughtful way, we call it disciplined growth. If we can inject disciplined growth and help companies grow, then those founders will have a better experience. They'll build a better company and they'll own more of it when the ultimate exit comes. WestCap's set up to fill that gap in the market by bringing our operating expertise and business plans to what we invest in.
How do you think about what you just said in the context of two industries? One venture is institutionalizing and not a small asset class by any means anymore, and is coming upstream. Venture firms have become multi-stage platforms. Some have growth investment arms. And then private equity is coming down. Blackstone, they have a technology investing business, some majority investments, some minority investments. And private equity firms are also investing in growth stage two. How do you think about what you just said and what you're building in the context of these two industry evolutions?
Sure. So on the one side, you've got the venture firms. They're typically set up to find ideas, match ideas with capital, and build a product. But they're not set up to operate and scale. It's not what they do. And the people who actually do it, partners, some have built something before, most haven't. And I say to our founders, this is special and this is your idea. Why would you trust it to somebody who's never built anything to help you build something, never mind something special? The answer is, oh, I guess you're right. Like, I know I'm right. And then on the other side, the asset aggregator side, I think as buyout firms move into growth, they drop their operating expertise because they don't own the full business. They don't control it. They're not going to bother putting operating resources. So there's a gap. There's no question there's a gap. And we're able to fill that gap by going to companies and we say, look, note, competitions, term sheets, bankers. Let's focus together about what you need to achieve your potential. And let's figure out together how to put that together. And that's why we have 100 people in the firm and 60 of them are full-time operators.
What's so fascinating about what you just said, and you have this massive stable of operating partners, you're almost applying a private equity operating partner model, not the model of, to make a distinction, venture firms have partners who were operators in the past, in some cases. You actually have a stable of operating partners who come in and help these businesses like a private equity firm, but you're not quite a private equity firm yourself. How do you apply that approach to slightly earlier stage investing or growth investing rather than true private equity investing where the operating partner model is a known and well-trodden concept?
So I'll tell you a funny story. After I left Airbnb, first person I called was actually Steve Schwarzman. I told him what I was up to and I explained to him what I just did. I have a thesis that there needs to be, I call it operating equity, by the way, not growth equity. There needs to be an operating equity firm that goes out and helps these firms scale. He goes, explain that to me. So, well, Steve, you go in, you have a thesis, you help the team scale over time, you invest in multiple rounds, you lead those rounds, you structure the deals, you help them all the way as what I call a life cycle investor from go-to-market fit to going public. Exactly what we did at Airbnb and what we did as investors in Airbnb. He goes, that's my idea. I call it Blackstone. And then he said to me, dare to be great, LT. And I reminded him of that when I just saw him a little while ago. I said, I remember he took credit for the idea and he did. It was his idea first. That's what Blackstone was originally. It was Pete Peterson and Steve Schwarzman going out and putting capital into corporate spinouts and other businesses they were scaling. That's where Blackstone started. That's why they're so entrepreneurial. That's still in their DNA today. If you ever ask John Gray what his career started as, I buy things, I fix them, and I sell. Same thing. It's an entrepreneur. So we're basically doing that in a space where, frankly, other firms aren't incented to invest in the operating capabilities because they don't control it. How do you get around that? You just be relevant. You just do a ton of work. You stay ahead of it. We're doing everything from writing S1s to hiring bankers to doing fundraising pitches to designing product to redesigning apps. It's a full factory. We can't do a lot of deals. I think that's a happy constraint. But that's basically how the idea came about to build the first operating equity firm.
What's the thing that companies and founders need most at the point at which you're investing?
I'm going to give you a non-answer because it really depends. We have 8 practice groups: talent, of course, go-to-market, financial excellence, cyber, product engineering, design, marketing, communications, and capital markets. With more than 8, some of those are subgroups. It depends. All those are the areas you need to be at least good at, if not great at, to build a great marketplace. You don't have to be perfect at everything, but you got to be good at more of them than not. And so it depends on where the company is. If I think today, in some of our smaller companies, we're recruiting management team, we're working on growth marketing and the return on invested capital. It depends on the life cycle, what you need to do. The biggest surprise for me over the last 5 years is how much the venture capital community has embraced our model as a partner. About half of our deals come from our research. We identify something like underinvestment in private market technology. There's Adepar, iCapital, and several other companies. Sometimes it's just simply inbounds from venture capitalists on the boards of the companies we're working with who say, hey, I've got this great business. Here's their 2 or 3 challenges. Can you guys come in? We'll come in. We'll do a check, 25 to 50 million. And if we can really gain conviction, we reserve the right to scale our position. It works really well. And that was the biggest surprise. Our phone, if there was a phone, is ringing off the hook with ideas. I wish we could do everything we see. We qualify it by the quality of the board, the quality of the people running the business, how much we really like them and think we can work with them. But that's been a big surprise, which says we were right that there was a gap here and we could fill it.
You talked a little bit about what you're doing at WestCap. We talked a bit about the business of Blackstone and how you built Blackstone as a business. What is the business of WestCap and what do you want to be?
So the existential question, the easy existential question, Michael. Actually, I have a very clear view of it. If we partner with the best long-term investors and connect that capital with the best ideas and generational founders of tomorrow, we're going to build some great companies that are going to change the world for the better. If we do that and we do it well, and we have the right people and right talent on our team, I always tell founders, we are not your investor until we invest, and then we work for you. That's our job. If we do that and we do it very well, we will build more generational companies like the Airbnbs and StubHubs and the TradeWebs and all the other things we've done over time. But the input is build great companies. The output will be the firm. I don't have any asset aspirations of what we want to be. I don't want to be an asset gatherer. I just want to build great companies. And that is fundamentally different than the business of being an asset manager. Sometimes founders will ask me, well, LT, what's the difference? I said, well, they're in the business of building their business. You're just one of the ways they get there. We're in the business of building your business. And what comes out of that is our firm. And everyone that joins this firm, I tell them that. We are not asset gatherers. We will never be able to be giant. We'll never do thousands of deals. It's just not in our DNA. Our DNA is to have fun building great companies and be intimately involved with them. That's a personal journey. That's not a financial journey. And I believe in the end, the personal journeys are ones that last longer than just a financial journey of, I just want to have a really big firm. I don't get that. I don't want to be part of that.
I love that description of how you talk about what you do, but also in the context of broader industry, asset management is a business. It's an industry and a business. I want to do something fun. I haven't done this yet, but I think this would be fun, particularly in light of you saying earlier on that you've found these patterns with a lot of the companies you built. So I'm going to name a company. You're going to name, in a quick fire round, an equivalency or an analogous company in private markets, or the first thing that comes to mind. I'll start with some of the old timers. So Tradeweb.
There isn't one yet. It's a total non-answer, but there isn't one yet. There isn't a scaled marketplace in the private space.
Who do you think will be the Tradeweb of private markets?
I think it'll be iCapital. I think iCapital will go to secondaries, and I think they'll have the first liquid private market for secondaries.
iLevel.
Wow, you're stumping me, Michael. These are like, it's like my own business. Treasury 4. I think the next version of iLevel will be actually moving cash, not just reporting results.
Iprio.
NASDAQ Second Markets.
Bloomberg.
This should be pointing out that these businesses don't exist in private markets today. Stump me again. Let me think for a second. Bloomberg for private markets. I guess that would probably be like DealBook or what's Crunchbase.
By the way, you can have the same answer for multiple things. If you think a certain firm may have elements or become that, you could also say that too. We're going to go a little bit wider here. Amazon.
Blackstone.
Why?
Just the depth of the marketplace they've built. Eventually, they could be in every asset class, and they have the quality of leadership and vision to actually do everything well. I think a lot of firms have chased Blackstone, both out here on the West Coast and on the East Coast, to trying to build this. We can be a supermarket. We can be the super Amazon to everything. And they've broken down because they didn't build it. The most key to Blackstone was it was built with risk management first, distribution second. Other people are doing distribution and products first, risk management second, and that will fall apart. So I think if you were going to have an Amazon, let's say the first $1 trillion alternative asset manager, it's going to be Blackstone.
Interesting. Interesting. Salesforce.
iCapital, for sure. The connection between how people manage what they're doing and how that works will be there.
So operating system.
Operating system. Oh, you're asking me operating system.
No, so...
Yeah, it's operating system.
That's your right. Salesforce, the operating system. iCapital is that for private markets. BlackRock.
Carlyle.
Why?
Big, diverse, lots of assets, lots of different places, things like that. I always thought of that firm as like a large platform collection of different businesses. That's what BlackRock is too.
Will there be an alternative asset manager who builds or adds technology in the way that BlackRock has done with Aladdin?
We spent a lot of time thinking about exactly that point. How do you build basically the system of record for your clients? It hasn't been done yet. It'll be interesting to see. I think it's more likely that gets built with a few of the firms involved, that it gets built by itself within one of the firms, because the undertaking would be enormous. And it would have to change the fundamental DNA. BlackRock was always in the technology business. And when Charlie Halleck built the first version of Aladdin, he built it to facilitate corporate treasury. GE, I think, was their first client. And he built it so that he could serve his clients. I don't think you have that today inside the alternative firms. That will be built outside of those firms. If you think about it, BlackRock bought eFront a few years ago, which is an administrative platform. We had looked at that at Blackstone and we found it was too manual. It was more of a services business. So I think that the Aladdin of alternative assets hasn't been built, but there's a little business called iAlta, which you're going to hear about in the next 6 months that we might have our paws in. So you may see it. It may be out there at some point.
I want to hear more about that when it makes sense. So two more. Vanguard.
Vanguard's equivalent in the private markets would be some of these high velocity businesses that are somewhat commoditized, like a Blue Owl would have massive credit books. That's what I would say is like the Vanguard or the index of the future. So it's these massive credit books. It's probably the REITs. I'd say these institutional REITs. These are the super commoditized $50 million minimum index-like businesses in real estate and credit. That's the equivalent of Vanguard.
The kind of nuanced part to my question was really who's going to build that low cost product? And is there a race to the bottom on fees? Vanguard created that race to the bottom on fees for a commoditized product. Is there someone who does that?
I think there will be. But I don't think it's going to be one of the alternative firms specifically. It's going to be a business development company like a Franklin Square that'll be able to have very cheap distribution and salespeople that are out there selling retail versions of credit funds and things like that. They'll get disrupted because the cost basis for a business development company is so much lower than what you have in any of these alternative managers, like literally down to the sales. So Franklin Square would be my bet on that one.
That's an interesting one as well. BDC is a whole space that's fascinating, by the way. So the last one, Goldman Sachs.
It's going to sound like I'm a broken record, but I think the Goldman Sachs of private markets is Blackstone. And I actually think Blackstone has a better long-term model. I remember when I first was looking at joining the company, I was fascinated. I said, I've never heard of a 12-year contract to pay fees at a 50% margin. That's just like amazing. And then you get paid the upside of your investments when they work out, but you don't have to take the consequence of the downside other than committed capital. It is literally the best business model in financial services history, I believe, the alternative model. It's better than hedge funds. It's better than investment banks. It is the best risk-adjusted asset class in all of financial services.
Well, that answer is not so crazy at all, because if you think about where Goldman's headed, they took different parts of the business and put it into GS Growth, and then their asset and wealth management division merged. They want to build a massive asset management division, and a lot of that's going to be driven by alts. So they're now trying to do the Blackstone.
One thought on that, Michael, I thought a lot about this. I thought about this in 2008 and 9 when I'd first gotten Blackstone. We'd done equity office, we'd bought Hilton, and all the analyst meetings I had in the early years, they'd give me a hard time about, oh, isn't Hilton going to go bust? And isn't that going to damage Blackstone? And that's why your stock's $4 a share versus 31 when you went public and all this other stuff. What I kept saying to them was, why are not any of the investment banks any good at real estate? The answer is because they were always playing with other people's money and they have annual bonus cycles and it wasn't their risk they were taking. And so all of them, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Whitehall, which was part of Goldman Sachs, all blew up. Why? Bad business model. And so I think it's very hard for a bank or even a traditional asset manager to be really good at alternatives because it takes a partnership mentality where you're an actual risk taker and the biggest risk you're taking is with your own capital side by side with your clients. And that's the model of alignment that Blackstone and the other alternatives innovated. And I think it's really hard to crack culturally.
That's such a fascinating thing to say at this point in the evolution of alts, because you're now seeing so many traditional asset managers as well as banks trying to get into this. So that observation is a really fascinating one as we see what unfolds in private markets.
I think that's right. I'll go long the partnerships and I'll go short the corporates, because in the end, you're investing in companies and you're building them. And that takes a partner and entrepreneur mentality, not an employee of a public company. Those are different things.
One question there, because Ares did just change their comp structure and they announced it where they're now going to shift a portion of the management team's carried interest into more stock awards, as far as I understand. The fact that these firms are now publicly traded companies and the goal is to make the stock price do well, does that change things of what you just said?
So first of all, I think Michael Arrighetti and the team at Ares has been amazing. I think they're really innovators and they really were the first ones to take a credit franchise, turn it into what they did. There is no question, having sat in front of institutional investors in the funds and institutional investors in a stock, that there's a tension there. There's no question about it. When I was at Blackstone, we protected very closely the businesses. So they were focused on the returns for the LPs and the funds, but it's really hard over time to do that. And that comes up, Michael, when you think about GP stakes, because all these firms are coming in and I've seen them all over the last 2 years trying to buy part of WestCap. And the answer always is, what if I stay smaller and the returns are even better? And they're like, yeah, maybe not. Maybe you just get bigger and the returns stay the same and you're fine. And I'm like, that's not the answer I want to get. And so that's just capturing future value and bringing it forward for the founders. So there is a conflict between asset gathering, asset growth, and quality returns. And that tension, Michael, is going to play out in the public markets. It's going to play out in private markets. It's going to play out in GP stakes. That's the evolution in the business.
I love that. That is such an important point to make and gets to the heart of this business. We could probably talk about that for a long time too. But the question I always ask every guest, which is, what is your favorite or most interesting alternative investment?
You mean favorite one over time or just in general?
It could be anything. Some people have said their own business. Some people have said some esoteric alternative investment that they like. Some people have said a company, a fund. It could be anything.
I think of all the businesses that I've been part of running, founding, investing in, I do think that building WestCap as a disruptor in the space to deliver something that management teams can only uniquely get from people who've been there before is probably the most fun I've ever had in my career and the most satisfaction. And I'm most proud of because it's been a lot of fun. We've got great partners. We're able to build some incredible businesses. I will never forget the day that we bought StubHub back from eBay for Eric Baker, the original founder. We were investors in Viagogo, which was business. And to be there that moment when we won that was one of those moments I'll never forget. And that's why we work so hard and we get great people to work with us and we work with people like that. And to be able to commit capital ideas and bring back to its original owner, someone who's so important to transform that business is one of those moments that I'll never forget for the rest of my life or my career. And that's why we do what we do. And that's what I'm most proud of.
I love that. We talked so much about evolution of industries and businesses, but to hear this at the end, I think is just such a great way to close this out. LT, thanks so much for coming on the Alcos Mainstream Podcast. Pleasure to have you.
Michael, thank you. And thank you for everything you're doing for the industry.
Appreciate it. There's more to do.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Alcos Mainstream. I hope you enjoyed it. You can read more about alts at my Substack, altgoesmainstream.substack.com. Thanks a lot and have a great day.